First State Farm Bureau, 99-159, Robert Mossing et al. Versus State Farm Insurance Company, Home Quays.
Did the tortfeasors insure, say they wouldn't pay you $300,000, you'd have to file suit, but they'd give you $200,000 if you didn't?
That's correct. We were negotiating for...
They wanted a discount on the policy.
Right. And we believe that under the Bogan analysis, since they would get credit for the full amount of the tortfeasor funds, we were safe in doing that. Plus, we had this consent to settle on waiver of subrogation rights. So we thought this was particularly, the Bogan analysis, particularly compelling in a case like this, because we have multiple claimants to a single limit policy. There's a $300,000 single limit policy. We have multiple claimants in the Mossing Chamber, plus we have the Stevenson claim. And potentially the Stevenson claim, we thought was a very valuable claim. And it did not settle, and we are settled. There's since been some allegations that it was, but it was in fact not settled by the
And Bogan says that when a policy has these exhaustion provision, that it cannot be enforced? I mean, what's Bogan say about that?
Yeah. I think Bogan says that if an insurer gets any amount under his tort fees or policy, he can settle that policy as long as he gives credit to the underinsured policy for the whole amount of those liability limits.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we didn't settle just any amount. It wasn't the tips. We got $200,000 or $300,000 with a significant claim still remaining. Of course, in this case, not only do we have a significant claim on stand, but we had consent to settle. And consent to settle, specifically said, you can settle for $200,000. And we hereby waive our subrogation.
What's significant about that? With regard to exhaustion?
Well, I think it's significant because I think when you consent, you by way of, you're giving up your exhaustion, right?
Except they. But you can't say that that happened here, can you?
Well, I think by the very fact that you give a consent, you can give up that argument.
You think that the letter from the insurer, the letter from the insurer said, but we don't give up our exhaustion rights. You're thinking maybe that wasn't effective, or?
I think that wasn't effective, because I think when you give your consent, you do in fact waive that exhaustion. I think if you look at Logan, it talks about that the exhaustion clause is a precondition.
Of course, in Bogan, it didn't include a further express reservation of their rights to claim that you didn't exhaust.
That's correct.
That'd be distinguishable in that regard, at least.
Except there's language in Bogan that says when exhaustion is a precondition to consent, so once you consent, we believe that you waive.
Under the terms of the policy, or under what? Where would it be a precondition?
Under the Bogan case.
Well, okay. There's no statute that makes it a precondition.
And I think it makes it a lot easier on everybody under the Solvus II analysis to Bogan, because the insurance company cannot be prejudiced. They're in no different position today as if we got the loss of intermediation from we're giving them credit. And it makes it a lot easier on everybody, because you don't have to worry about that. You worry about the inflexible situations and things that might arise. But, for example, in this case, we have two claimants, two major claimants, a passenger and a wrongful death claimant. Who goes first? Who gets what amount? When do you settle? You have to wait around until Stevenson settles before the wrongful death claimant settles. So by simply adopting a standard rule, that we simply give them credit, no one is prejudiced. If we go forward, and Alonzo go forward in the trial court for a damage plan, we in effect have to prove damage in excess of $288,000. And under the credit analysis, that's exactly what they'll get, credit for $288,000.
Was your original demand of the tortfeasor's carrier $300,000? Policy limit?
In excess of $300,000.
Well, by that time, you knew the policy limits were $300,000.
Yes.
So you demanded at least the policy limits.
Yes. In addition to the claims, there are numerous State Farm policies involved. There are under insurance policies involved here. And in addition to the claim of the administrator, we believe that under the Wicker case, that the individuals would have claims under their own policy as well.
Did the letter from State Farm with reservation of rights raise any alarm in you or red flags?
No, I don't believe so, because we felt that's an outstanding claim, and technically both claimants would have the right to that whole $300,000. We felt that we were relatively safe in going forward.
And also the fact that
I think they all agree it's way over 300,000.
Yes, look, Your Honor, if you look at Solvus II of Bogan, since they're going to receive that credit anyway, regardless of what we get, as long as we get some settlement, then they can't
credit us.
Yeah,
there's some money.
Your Honor, we are requesting, basically, based on clause two, that this court remand the case to the trial court, so that we would be allowed to prove our damages against State Farm Insurance. And we believe that what it would mean is the court's advantage to set a rule and adopt the credit analysis, because in that analysis, no one gets hurt. In that analysis, State Farm gets exactly what they want. They get the credit for whatever the tort fees or limits are. It eases the situation with the insured, because they don't have to guess on what they have to do. They don't have to get involved in this cost of litigation business. They don't determine what the costs are, what percentage is going to be enough. They can simply sell and move on to their insurance coverage.
Thank you, Mr. Quaid. Mr. Delaney.
Chief Justice, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for possible rebuttal.
They're not across the field, are they?
Pardon?
They're not across the field, are
they? No, there is. Okay.
No, you don't get rebuttal like you're an athlete.
No, that's rather rural.
Yeah.
In this case, we are asking the court not to accept this idea of a credit analysis for a number of reasons. First, there's nothing in 3937.18.82 about a credit analysis. What is involved in the statute, what this court has decided in the past, is what the insured is entitled to for underinsured motorist coverage is the amounts available for payment. In this case, the record was quite clear that $288,000 was, at the moment of the effects of settlement, available to the Mossings, and they decided to settle anyway. The statute itself talks about the amount available to the policyholder, and then the limits correspondingly, the limits of liability for the underinsured carrier start at the amount of limits minus what was paid to the insurer. Obviously, there will be circumstances where an insurer will settle the claim for less than the tort fees limits. Now, what we've had here in Ohio since Bogan, and I read your dissent, Justice Douglas, and I had a problem from the start, but we have had a system in Ohio that has permitted policyholders to accept less than the tort fees limits of coverage, give a full release, and proceed with an underinsured motorist claim under certain circumstances. I think if you go from Greece, if I have my count correct, there are only 10 cases that have made it as unreported reported decisions by our Court of Appeals involving situations where the insured has accepted less than the state limits of coverage. Many of these obviously have been found against the insured, but they are not pursuing the claim, they're abandoning the claim as adopted by a vote. Another practical problem with this credit analysis is that really what it does, in part, invites bad faith negotiating on the part of the tortfeasor's carrier. There's no incentive for the tortfeasor's carrier to bargain in good faith in a liability case where they know the damages can just be paid by carrier number two on the other side of the uninsured motorist carrier. It would permit these carriers to negotiate in a way not to pay the true value of the claim. Let's just assume that one of these claims is settled for an amount of $30,000 or $50,000 available for coverage.
Counsel,
yes,
we wouldn't have the problem we have today if the insurance company just said, hey, we're not going to let you settle for that amount. It's way lower than the limits. Get more money. Why did you say, or why did you give them permission to settle the case?
We have a subrogation right on the policy, which has been recognized by this court. And they had an option to exercise the right. They were waived the right to. They were faced with a settlement. And they said, we will not give away of this settlement. They will waive any potential subrogation. But we are reserving the right coverage based on
the failure to prove the loss. But by giving them permission to settle the case, that you are giving them permission to not exhaust the entire amount that's available.
I think what the State Farm did and what they did in this case, they consented to the idea of the settlement. The idea, if the Mossman so chose, to terminate the claim at some $200,000, they couldn't reasonably be justified in getting in the way of what these people wanted to do.
But shouldn't we hold the parties responsible to their voluntary acts? And shouldn't we hold wherein an insurance company gives permission to settle that they cannot raise the non-exhaustion clause in their policy as a defense?
I don't think so, because I think once the policyholder makes a decision that we're going to settle this claim, in this case, wrong at that point for $200,000, the insurance company has to respond and make a decision.
There's no doubt that this claim is worth more than the coverage the tortfeasor had. Is there?
You would assume that it was.
I think I read where they have a claim of $1.5 million in lost wages alone.
This is what they are.
Right. So it's not a question of valuation, is it?
Well, you know.
Where is it?
It shouldn't be, but I don't know. We can't step in their shoes and understand why they're doing this. I mean, it was a voluntary act on their part.
So you feel it's okay if the insurance company feels, if on one hand they say to themselves they're not getting enough money, but on the other hand, we give you permission to settle. You feel that justifies the settlement?
I'm sorry, saying the insurer, they believe they're not getting enough money?
No, the insurance guy, the carrier didn't feel that they got enough money from the tortfeasor, correct? They only got $200,000, didn't they? And that you're saying to us that, hey, listen, you should have gotten more money from the tortfeasor.
Yeah.
And I see that. I think that's a valid claim on your part.
And of course, the contract law, I mean, this exhaustion clause follows the entitlement clause on these policies. Excuse me, start out with, they will pay damages you are legally entitled to recover. And the second, next paragraph is the exhaustion clause in bold letters, capitals.
All I want is an answer to this question. Does the insurance company have an obligation to tell the insured to get more money before we give you our okay to settle? Don't you have that obligation to your company?
I don't believe that we can stand in the way. It would not be reasonably justified to stand in the way of their unilateral act to accept particular in these circumstances some $200,000.
But you're saying that the insurance company has a right to tell them to settle for any amount, even though we really feel they should have gotten more money, and all we have to do is put a reservation of our rights in the letter also.
Well, you know, I don't think that at all. In fact, that's not what the case law stands for.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
The plaintiff's insurance company is not directly involved in negotiating the settlement with the tortfeasor's insurance company.
That's correct.
As a matter of business, I mean, you don't do that, I assume.
No, we don't. I don't think we can do that. First of all, I think I would correct the record, Justice Douglas. This suit was filed July of 1990 and had been pending for over a year by the time it was level on Mossing. So it wasn't a situation, I don't believe, where I had to compel the lawsuit. The suit wasn't actually filed and had been pending. The problem in this case that I see.
Well, I didn't know that I made that point.
Okay. Well,
the only point I made is that, isn't it so, Mr. Delaney, and you know it, probably as well or better than anybody in this state, since we know each other for a long time, that every time you have a policy limits case, the carrier that you're dealing with always says, the lawyer always says, all right, it's $300,000. We'll give you $250,000 now, otherwise file your lawsuit. Because we want to shave something, we always use the term, shave something off the policy limits. Does that still happen?
That certainly happens.
Okay. And that's really what Bogan was all about, and that's why the exhaustion problem is a problem, because I guess practically we know that you never get from the tortfeasor without a suit, the tortfeasor's carrier, the policy limits, because they might as well hold on to it until it's time to pay.
I think Bogan correctly says $1,700 insured is when you sell the insured satisfies the exhaustion requirement when he or she sells for an amount and proceeds. But Bogan, Your Honor, didn't state any amount, it says an amount. And in this case, there's a complaint about Stevens' complaint being pending and so forth. The record below is clear. Appendix 9 of my brief, the pretrial conference was held in December of 1991, where all of these factors were discussed. Mr. McQuaid was present, the attorney for Diane Stevenson was present. At that time, he made a demand of $12,000 for her claim. It was clear that $288,000 at that moment was available. And another settlement pretrial was set forth the following January. The affidavit of Mr. Gibby, the next supply, attached to my brief, demonstrated that both claims, Stevenson and Mossy, had been settled before January 19th and before State Farm, my signature, sent this letter February 12, 1992.
Yeah, I think that's all important to point out and is fair, and the fairest thing is you sent the letter that should have put somebody on notice that there was something else floating around that they ought to be careful of. But I guess my concern would be, you don't specifically say, you say you might have a reservation of rights with regard to the wrongful death claim being asserted by your clients against maybe our company, and then you go on and say that there's $288,000 to $290,000 available. Why wouldn't the letter have just said, and unless you exhaust pursuant to section 23 of the policy, no claim will be recognized? The reason you didn't do that is because you didn't want to scare them out of the settlement. Would that be fair?
Well, I think, perhaps the verdict is a little like, but I think it was pretty clear what our intent was.
Yeah.
In the court below, if I may, Judge Glasser said that it doesn't get any more clear than that tonight. I made mistakes, I know that, but I think it was pretty clear in that letter to Stevenson. So,
would you write this letter?
Yes, I did. I used the words more importantly to point out the fact that exhaustion was a problem here.
And so the fact that your company would not be prejudiced is of no consequence.
Well, I think they would. I think the idea of this concept of credit analysis taking any amount could result in prejudice to the carrier. Now, first of all, the idea is that State Farm is always going to be, or the carrier is always going to get a subtraction of what was received by the tort agency. But in the real world, Justice Resnick, well, most of these cases, 90% of these cases, are settled before they go to suit or to a trial or arbitration. And any plaintiff's lawyer worth his salt is going to tell the carrier in a damages case of this nature, this is how much this is how much we really need, we're going to try. The idea that we're going to get this set off for subtraction or non-prejudicial effect of state law really gets lost in the shuffle. Now, if I were an imaginary defense attorney, depending on these claims, one of those cases talked about the injured party getting $30,000 out of $50,000 available, I think what I would do to defend this tortfeasor when the underinsured carrier came back is I would, in Northwest Ohio, a lot of imaginative lawyers that you know, I asked the trial judge to permit me to enter into evidence the fact that someone independently took a look at the medicals, took a look at the liability, took a look at this, and put $30,000 on this claim. Now, I would think that would be prejudicial. They're an example of prejudice. This is an unfortunate case, and it's unfortunate for us to be here. This contract requirement, which was acknowledged in Bogan, was clearly set forth in the contract, clearly explained to the insurers before they entered into this settlement.
Quaid has taken a little over 4 minutes to bring the question in now.
Before you settled.
Yeah, we thought that we could consent to settle in a waiver of subrogation rights. That's all we really needed, particularly with the outstanding claim.
So you didn't think you had any problem in reading that what you received from the insurance company, that you're going to have a problem down the line if you settle for $200,000?
We didn't think so, you know, given the law in Bogan.
But that seems like if that might be bad faith. I mean, you argue there's lack of good faith on the part of the insurer. I mean, for you to represent your client and ignore that second half of the letter, second sentence that says we will not, you know, that is that acting in good faith to say, well, we'll show them, you know, we'll just go ahead and then we'll sue them. And
you know, this was a very difficult time for the Muslims.
I don't doubt that.
And they lost their son.
I'm just saying that, you know, to say bad faith, I mean, on the other hand, somebody could argue that it wasn't all that great shakes for the other side to ignore that extra phrase, that we don't forego our rights under the exhaustion.
Well, insuring. But we felt, again, once given the present state of the law, that if they got credit for the full amount, then we...
Yeah. And that could have been put in the letter. You know, here's our debate over the Bogan case.
Yes. And this has been a difficult, very difficult time for the Mossings this past 10 years, litigating this case.
You need your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.